Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House Finance Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, October 28, 2015. Time is 12:37 p.m. Members present are Representative Wilson, Pruitt, Vice Chair Sadler, Co-Chair Thompson, myself, Co-Chair Newman, Representative Gaddis, Representative Edgman, and Representative Munoz. We do expect the other members shortly. Today's agenda is the TransCanada buyout proposal, or the termination proposal. Today we're going to hear from Vincent Lee. Vincent's the Director of Major Projects for Development for the TransCanada, and he's going to make a brief statement for us and then be available for members to ask questions of TransCanada's current and possibly future roles or where they're at in this. I think he's pretty open on the questions he's got coming, so he's been prepared for this. Also welcome Representative Guttenberg. We do have many legislators that do come in and out of the meeting, and I'd love to mention you all as you come back in, but I think most legislators, if they're not here in the meeting, they're probably watching in their offices. So I suspect probably every member of the legislature is available and watching what's going on.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And members of the committees, for the record, my name is Vincent Lee. I am the Director of Major Projects Development at TransCanada. I serve as the commercial lead on the TransCanada in the Alaska LNG project, and I represent TransCanada on the Projects Management Committee. In late 2013, TransCanada and the state agree on a memorandum of understanding, which I will refer that to as the MOU, that established the material terms for TransCanada to hold an equity participation interest in the Alaska LNG project and to provide gas treatment and transportation services to the state for the state shares of the gas in the Alaska LNG project. Following the passage of SB 138, TransCanada entered into a precedent agreement, which I will be referring that to PA, with the state in June 2014, which formalized the material terms that were agreed to in the MOU. The PA allows either party to terminate the agreement. Over the last few months, the governor has been very clear with Alaskans about his desire for the state of Alaska to take on a bigger role in the Alaska LNG project. The administration has testified that it is recommending terminating the present agreement with TransCanada. TransCanada agrees with this recommendation. With that, TransCanada has concluded that it is no longer commercially reasonable to remain in the Alaska LNG project. TransCanada supports the appropriation for buying out TransCanada's interest in the Alaska LNG project. It is the state's prerogative under the present agreement to terminate the agreement with TransCanada, and we respect the recommendations of the administration. We are working diligently with the administration on an exit plan to ensure the termination occurs as smoothly and reasonably as possible to allow the project momentum to be maintained. TransCanada has been involved in advancing a natural gas pipeline in the state of Alaska for more than four decades and has made significant contributions to the advancement of the current LNG efforts. Departing the project was a very difficult decision for TransCanada to make, and we have not made that decision lightly. But we believe it is in all involved parties' interest for us to do so. Anticipating our departure, and the termination will soon happen, I will take this opportunity to wish our project partners in the state of Alaska well in this endeavor to bring Alaska's abundant natural gas resources to the global markets. Mr. Co-Chairs and members of the committees, I also would like to extend my thanks to you for inviting me here today. This concludes my opening remarks, and I'm now available for questions that you may have.
Thank you, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Lee, thank you for being here. Could you give us just a little more detail about TransCanada's involvement in the Alaska's desires for a natural gas pipeline of any flavor over the past 30, 40 years? Just a little more detail so we understand to what extent your company has been involved in Alaska gas issues.
Representative Sadler, through the chairs, TransCanada involvement started in late 70s, early 80s. In I believe the first go around in terms of looking for a transportation system to monetize the Alaska gas, what it were at that point in time called Alaska Natural Gas Transportation System. Transcare was involved as one of the partners at that point in time with numbers of North American pipeline companies to develop that system. That effort, unfortunately, came to an end in the mid-80s because of the fundamental market changes in North America. And the effort resurfaced a number of times with different effort over time, looking at different configurations like, you know, RNG options and so on. And I think, you know, as recent as in 2004, TransCanada, with the market changes, TransCanada re-engaged in the project in a more active form, and we participate in what we used to call the Stranded Gas Development Act process. We negotiate a term sheet with the administration at that point in time. Governor Murkowski decided to go with the producer with the proposal at that point in time, and it evolved over time to becomes we're making applications as a result of the Alaska Gas Line Development under the Alaska Gas Line Development Act, AGIA, and we were granted a license by the legislature in 2008, late 2008, and we were the AGIA licensee. We worked jointly with ExxonMobil on that project until 2003, 2004, as a result of the significant shale gas development in the Lower 48, granted that project uneconomic, and we team up with ConocoPhillips and BP to work on the current LNG effort. So that was kind of the history of TransCanada involvement in Alaska.
Just briefly, did you mean 2013, 14?
Oh, sorry, 2003,
yeah, 2004.
So 2000, okay, yeah.
Just want to clarify.
Thank you for correcting me.
Okay. That's what I've got other questions. Actually, well, I guess.
Representative.
Thank you, sir. You said in your opening remarks, sir, that it became clear at a certain point the administration was not desirous of moving forward with TransCanada. When to you did that become clear, and in what form did that become clear to you? I mean, how did you sense that it was not working out?
We have been hearing, a statement made by the governor early on last year regarding his desire, his belief that it might be best for the state of Alaska to own the entire 25% of the project by buying back TransCanada interest in the project. We have discussion with Department of Natural Resources in late May, early June timeframe, and it was expressed to us that it's a strong desire the administration would like to proceed with such a buyout, and we agreed to start working on a plan to ensure there will be a transition. Since then, you know, we have been working with the administration cooperatively to look in, you know, to work on a plan such that we would exit in all the defections and has as little impact to the project momentum as possible. And we are still working on that at this point in time. I think the result of the appropriation bill is a step in that direction.
And my last question, I promise, on that line, just because there's a lot of different trails that we're going to follow as we ask our questions, I'm sure. But you said that they started working on a plan after early June on the transition, on the extinguishment. Was that the amended plan or the amendment participation agreement plan? There's been some reference to something called an amended plan. Is that the document or the plan you're referring to?
Representative said through the chair, yes, it was known to be an amended precedent agreement. The idea was to amend the existing precedent agreement to incorporate the details of an exit plan, how that is going to work. And again, you know, the objective is to ensuring that there will be a smooth transition.
Okay. On that point.
I said final.
On that, just while we're on that point with the amended plan, December 4th, can you elaborate on why December 4th is such an important date to wrap up this plan?
December the 4th is the deadline for parties in the joint venture agreement, the PFI joint venture agreement, to vote for the next year work plan and budget. And without that work plan and budget, it will put at risk the project progress because the project would not have any funding to carry out any activities for next year. And in order to be able to get the budget approved, as TransCanada, knowing very well that, you know, we are leaving the project, it would not be appropriate for us to make an affirmative vote. It would not be a good faith vote on our part. And so it is important for us to make sure that the buyout would be complete and the stay would be in TransCanada positions and be able and become the party to the JUA for the midstream component of the project so that the stay on December the 4th can make its own decision as to what to do with the 2014 WPMB work plan and budget.
Thank you. Representative Satterjee.
Yes, again, thank you for letting me follow that up through the chair. And that amended plan that I understand was not actually executed, the precedent agreement was not amended to include those amendments, but to your knowledge, are we still operating on the terms of that amended PA?
It's
hardly different from what we have in front of us in the PA.
Representative Satterjee, through the chair, the amended PA has not been executed. It's been put on shelf. So in a way, yes, we are not operating under the amended PA, but rather we are operating under the existing PA, which you have a copy, a redacted copy. But the plan is that, you know, as we move forward from here, we will work with the administration to come up with what we will call a purchase and sales agreement, which effectively provide the framework for TransCanada to convey our interest in the project to the administration in return for the state of Alaska to pay the amount of cost that TransCanada has spent on this project up to the day of closing, and also going to contain certain other provisions to ensure there is a process in there to making sure that there will be a smooth transition. Yeah.
You done?
Yes, sir. Back in the queue, though.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lee, if the buyout or the termination clause does not occur with the state of Alaska's request, will TransCanada exercise its option to opt out?
Mr. Co-Chair, certainly that's the right TransCanada has as well. And I would not be able to definitively saying, you know, one way or the other at this point in time, but I believe that we would definitely seriously consider that as an option.
Thank you. Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Going back to that December 4th partners meeting, if you want to call it, should this legislation pass, the appropriation, at what point does the state of Alaska have the right to go into that December 4th meeting and be the vote? Do you have to be paid in full prior to December 4th to relinquish that voting right that you presently have?
Mr. Co-Chair, yes, you will have to fully pay TransCanada for the transaction to take effect, such that we will convey our full interest to the state of Alaska, which in turn allows you to have the full rights to vote on December the 4th.
So you would have to have the check by December 4th in order for the state to have that voting right?
Mr. Co-Chair, yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Pruitt?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So appreciate you being here and giving us a little bit of your thoughts. Can you remind the committee of just TransCanada? You've given us your history. Can you give me just a real quick reminder of what you currently have globally in terms of assets and what you guys have developed.
Representative Perret, Fruit Chair. Most of our investment are now in North America. We have three major businesses. We have a pipeline, natural gas pipeline business, liquids pipeline business, and energy business, primary power generation facilities in both U.S., Canada, and Mexico. We have some investment in Southern America as well. That was a result of years ago that, you know, we have, you know, our involvement in international investment, but we have divested significant amount of those investment in the early 2000s. If you look at TransCanada portfolio today, we have, I believe we have like 68,000 kilometers of pipes across North America. We have probably something in the range of 11,000 megawatt of power generation facilities. We have a lot of expertise in developing those projects, both pipelines and energy projects. And I think our market capitalization, I believe, is in the range of $35 billion, roughly. Yeah.
Thank you. Continue, Mr. Chair. So based on some of the what you've indicated and the expertise that it sounds like you have, I'd like to ask the next couple questions. First and foremost, the project that we're currently discussing, in your expertise, do you feel that it makes sense?
Mr. Perret, for the chair, our involvement in AKRNG is in the midstream portion, which is the gas treatment plant and the pipelines. We have significant expertise, of course, in the pipelines. We do also have good expertise in the gas treatment plant. Years ago, TransCanada had a significant processing business. We sold off that business in, again, early 2000s, but we still have in-house, you know, expertise in that business. You know, you probably have heard before that, you know, the pipeline lead of the AK LNG project is a TransCanada person. And we have total 15 secondees. I know that you have seen 12 on the chart. It is correct because the three of TransCanada secondees are in the administrative role, which is not shown up on the chart. That's why total actually is 15. You know, through those secondees and the access to the depth of knowledge in the organizations. You know, I'm very confident that, you know, we have made significant contribution in the advancement of the project for that matters. Having said that, you know, we have very strong partners in the project. You have the three largest integrated oil and gas company in the world. Each of them are world-class companies with significant expertise in across the whole value chain in the energy business. Personally, I believe that, you know, the three producers with the depth of their experience and knowledge in, you know, mega project will be able to carry out this project together with AGDC expertise without any difficulties.
So continue, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that, but I want to still, I guess, reiterate the question again. So we've got some good partners. Just more succinctly, do you feel the project makes sense, that us moving forward in this project, it would be, if you were still a part of it, would be a good value, a good asset for you to be a part of, that you feel that you could make money from?
Representative Perret, through the chair, yes. We are a strong believer of this project. We think this is a good project. I think this project has a lot of potentials. You know, we believe, regardless of the status of TransCanada in this project, the project itself has a lot of potentials. And that's the reason why, you know, one of our objectives of departing from the project is to ensure the project momentum is not going to get impact, because we do see that this is a good project, and we also understand this project is a very important project to the state of Alaska. And we want to make sure that the project will be able to continue on its schedule as we exit.
Yeah, continue. So thank you. I appreciate that piece. So the next question I have is if this is seen as a valuable project, one that you could see it being profitable, TransCanada, if they stayed a part of it, could benefit from. You've given us a glowing reason. You told us that you feel that you're confident that TransCanada can step aside. And so if it's not because there's no money in it, my concern at this point is the other side. Has the state of Alaska created an environment where you feel that you should step away and you've been pushed aside? Do we? And then second from that, if we're stepping aside, do we have the expertise in your mind to be able to step in and fill the void that you guys are leaving?
Representative Perrett, for the chair, I think from I thought what I answered earlier on was the fundamentals of the project. So I think the fundamentals of the project, as I see today, it got a lot of potentials. Regarding the relationship between, you know, the state of Alaska and TransCanada, that's a bilateral matter. And I think what we're seeing here is that the current administration has a different philosophy when it comes to how they see the role of state of Alaska in the project. Previous administrations believing that, you know, it will be advantageous to the state of Alaska long-term to have an independent pipeline involved. I think the current administration, I can't speak on their behalf, but this is just my own personal opinion, is not that they don't believe that there's a value for an independent pipeline around, but I think they believe stronger is that, you know, it will be less costly to the state of Alaska, and perhaps without TransCanada in the picture, the state will have more influence on the directions of the project. And with that two considerations, this administration decided that it may be better to have TransCanada to not in this project and have the state to step up to the whole 25% interest. Regarding these capacity and the ability for the state to manage the project, I'm not as knowledgeable in terms of the credential of each individual with the state, you know, whether it's in the AGDC or in other departments of the state. But for those which I work with closely, like Mr. Joe Duper with AGDC, Fritz Krusen with AGDC, I think they are very knowledgeable person. They are, Fritz, for example, he has many years of experience in developing mega project, LNG project. So I don't have doubt in my mind that, you know, as an individual concern, you know, for those that I know, they are capable and have the ability to manage the project without TransCanada.
Can I follow up just on that piece? Should be the last one for now. So with that being said, you've also explained that you have $35 billion worth of assets, a considerable amount of pipelines and others. So it would reason to for me to believe that there is a layer of expertise within your organization. Do you feel that we have the expertise of building a line that we are talking about, that it seems like from what we've heard that your company potentially has? Do we have that level of expertise within either AGDC or the Alaska, the gas line team, to be able to step into the role that you guys are stepping aside from?
Representative Perrett, through the chair, I first thing is that, you know, I think what Mr. Joe Duber has described in terms of the project structure is correct. Like, Transcan involvement in the project will be at the project management level, which oversees the project program and manage the project program. We are not a construction company. We will not be the one going to build a pipeline. All the pipeline that we own in TransCanada, we are not the one actually build it. We manage the process, we manage the development, we manage the permitting and things like that. But we are not the one actually who build it. So with that, yes, it is true, you know, TransCanada as an organization has significant institutional knowledge in terms of, you know, developing. When I say building, is really, you know, managing the process of building and operating the pipeline. No doubt about that. That's our core business. With the state of Alaska, I think that skill set and knowledge will build over time. I mean, AGDC is a young organization, and I do not believe we should think about AGDC as being a company that is growing, be equated to TransCanada, who has been in the business for 70 years. I think that is not a fair comparison. It would have to, over time, it would acquire the experience and the skills. And meanwhile, you know, as this project getting developed, there are other partners in there as well who have many, many, many years of experience, has deep knowledge on all aspects of the energy industry. So as a group, I think, you know, the project will continue on and people will make the right decisions. And if we get to FID and if the final investment decision is affirmative decisions, it will get built.
Yeah, I just wondered, and Representative Pruitt, we're going to have Steve Butt, the project manager for the project development team, on Friday, I believe, from Exxon, and explain how the project development team decides who is on that team, who does what, and how decisions are made to move forward. You could have a entity that may be off wall or off track, but the rest of them all have to vote together on that to try and protect the interests as a whole. Is there anything you could add on that, Mr. Vincent, or Mr. Lee, as to how that project development team works together to ensure that the lowest prices for the cost of development on this is done and the best decisions are made?
Mr. Co-Chair, the project management team is a collection of expertise from the various participants in the project. The three producers, currently the three producers in TransCanada, and I'm sure in the future there will be secondees from AGDC as well. There's a project management committee. The project management committee oversees the project management team. And from a technical perspective, the technical team carry out the technical work. And the fact that I think you have the free resource owners as key participants in this project, the motivation I would have to believe that is profit maximization. And the key to profit maximization will be to, number one, make sure that, you know, your cost is going to be managed as low as possible. So from that perspective, you've got a natural safeguard that decision made by the free producer likely is going to be making sure that the cost of the project is going to be as low but reasonable as possible. So just on a cost control side of things, what I have seen so far is the project team has done a very good job. You know, they look at all aspects of the project. They evaluate the risk of different elements of the project, and we are at the pre-FEED stage, and things are going to get refined over time as we move forward into FEED, and at the end of FEED, you know, there will be a better information. The information will be at a higher quality for everyone to make a decision at that point in time to decide whether it is warranted to go to construction or not.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for being here, Vincent. And I just got to say, Patty and Tom and Tony, I mean, we're on first-name basis with TransCanada since I was a freshman on the Oil and Gas Committee. And I've really appreciated that openness and working together. And so I've got that song, Breaking Up is Hard to Do, in the back of my head right now. now it's really going to be stuck. And so, you know, this is with a little bit of a bittersweet kind of as we move forward. I asked Marty this question the other day, and she gave me an answer, and I'd like to hear it from you too, whether you would consider this exit more of a messy divorce or a mutual disillusion. Because I have a divorce friend lawyer, turned legislator in the back there.
Representative Kawasaki for the chair. First of all, thank you for the kind words. And I would consider the letter. I think it's the mutual dissolutions. It's from TransCanada perspective, you know, it is important for us when we enter into any project as we're developing any project, is to manage the risk of the project. And the key elements of managing the risk is we need to have an alignment with our customer. And as we see, the administration is thinking of doing the project in a different way. We don't feel the alignment is as strong as it used to be. And that doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad thing. It's just that, you know, we are approaching the project from a different angle. And as a result of that, you know, we sat down with the administration, we talked through the issues, and we understand each other as to what's the concern and the needs. And I think we both decided that, you know, this is probably the right thing for us to do. It took some time to get to that point, but I think when you look at it from TransCanada perspective, we believe it's the right thing to do.
Follow up. Through the chair, thank you. Did you try couples counseling? Let me just, I guess, I do, actually. I guess if those differences are irreconcilable, I guess you do go your separate ways, but the question was asked a little earlier, and I'd like to follow up on if the legislature doesn't approve it, the buyout provisions and the money, the administration through Commissioner Meyer said that he won't sign that off-ramp, but you might in fact do that, and I'd just like you to, is it at the board level, is it at the project level, at which that decision would be made for TransCanada?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, if I understand your answer correctly, I think you are asking me about in the event if the state decide not to, or the legislature decide not to approve the appropriations, what TransCanada is going to do. Will we exercise the termination right to exit the project or some other things? As I have mentioned earlier, you know, I think sure we do have termination rights as well, and I do not know exactly what TransCanada would do at that point in time because we have been focusing on the current path. But clearly, you know, it will be something that we will consider seriously.
And follow up: would that be done through the board level, or would it be done through a project level, or I guess? Who would make that determination on behalf of TransCanada?
It will be TransCanada board and management to make that decision.
And I have one more clarification, Mr. Chair, on a question. In the testimony, the written testimony, there was a discussion that you agree with the governor's recommendation. Immediately following that sentence, maybe a sentence or two down, it said something about TransCanada finds commercially disagreeable. I can't remember what the language was. Can you?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, I think you were referring to me saying that, you know, we concluded it's no longer commercially reasonable for us to remain in the project.
As a partner. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Lee, if the producers decided for some reason to not participate in this project but made their gas available at commercially reasonable rates, do you feel TC would consider rejoining the project in some fashion?
Mr. Co-Chair, it's difficult for me to answer that question because, you know, I think we will have to have all the facts in front of us at that point in time before we know, you know, what are we looking at before we can make any decisions. So it's you know, at this point in time, I think it's premature for us to give any definitive answer on that.
Thank you. Representative Gare.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lee, along the lines of Representative Kawasaki, though, I'm not going to use the divorce analogy, and I'm not sure what a breakup that's not a divorce. I don't know. I'll leave that to him. I do want to say to you and your management team, obviously your job is to make as much money as you can for your company in as good a way as you can, but I also think that over the years, your management team have been straight shooters when they've come before this legislature. Sometimes tempers have flown. I've seen it, but I do appreciate, and I wish you would send up to Mr. Palmer that at least I think that you've been straight shooters, and, of course, you've represented your interests well. So, just to get one thing out of the way, everybody's used this word secondees, and for a while I didn't know what it meant, but a secondee is either an employee or an appointee, right? Is that right?
Representative Garrett, through the chair, yes. And first of all, thank you for your kind words. I will pass on a message to Tony. Yes.
Thank you. All right, thank you. Let me go to what I think are a few of the cruxes of this issue. For those of us who have decided we want to buy out, many of us want to do that because we believe it saves the state money if the project doesn't go ahead, and it makes us more money if the project does go ahead. So if the decision were made by this legislature to keep you in this project, and a year from now you decided to leave, you said, you know, it's not in our interest to remain on this project. You incur your costs through the next year. We owe you all of those costs, plus we owe you 7% on top of that under the contract. Is that correct?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, by and large, that's correct, yes.
Okay. So it's nothing personal for some of us who are looking at this. We have to look at what is in the state's best financial interest. You hit on the issue of, do you think this project is feasible? And we've all sort of, in the shorthand, referred to you as a pipeline builder, but that's not what you really are. What you are is a pipeline owner. That's the biggest part of your business. And you own, you run a pipeline, you charge the parties who use your pipeline, and you make money that way. Is that fair?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, that's correct. We are pipeline developer, owner, and operator.
Okay. And thank you, through the chair. Sorry about that. And let's say the circumstances were different, and we had a law on the books right now, which was TransCanada is going to become the 100% pipeline owner. And, of course, we don't know exactly what the price of gas is going to be by the time we get to the next phase. But if we had a contract with you that you would be the pipeline owner, be responsible for the costs, would you keep moving ahead with this project?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, there's a lot of assumptions in your questions. a lot is going to be based on facts at the time of costs. We are at the previous stage. I think you have seen all parties involved in this project at this point are very motivated to continue to move forward this project. I think that is the best testament of everyone is believing this project has a lot of potentials. You need to continue to gather more facts and solidified additional information and find a way to mitigate risks that have been identified. If we are 100% owner of the pipeline, as we stand today, The answer is yes, we will.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, through the chair. And the answer is yes, because at this point you feel like it seems feasible enough that it's worth to continue investing. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you. And through the chair, if I can get to one other area, please. We've seen charts before, and many of us who've been around for a while know this, though you could correct me, but in these shorthand words we use, pre-FEED and FEED, and then you get to construction, the big cost of this project, 95% of this cost is roughly 94% of this cost is going to be in the construction phase. And at that point, as a pipeline owner, which is you in many projects, and if you're not here, will be the four other parties, you don't spend that 95% of the cost, that huge cost, until you have a seller of gas, because as a pipeline owner, you want to make sure you get gas into your pipe, until you have a committed buyer of gas, because you want to make sure that gas is going to generate revenue, and until you have the facts that say the people who are willing to sell the gas are going to sell it at a price to buyers that make the project feasible. That's when you make the construction decision, right? Is that correct?
Representative Guerra for the chair. As a pipeline service provider, the way it works for us is before we go to an FID, a final investment decisions, we will require a firm transportation service agreement from a creditworthy party. We will never own the gas because we are service transportation services provider, nor are we going to sell the gas. The gas will always remain with the shipper. And so the model that you describe is not the model that typically what TransCanada would enter into in any typical pipeline arrangement with our shippers. But what we will require typically to make a firm final investment decisions is that we would require a firm transportation services agreement with a creditworthy shipper.
And through the chair. Finally, thank you.
Later, and then, well, I'd like to have some other members ask some questions first. We rotate through, and we can come back later. But go ahead for now.
And it's not until you know all of that, what you just described, that you wouldn't spend the money on the construction until you know all of that is in place. Is that correct? The big cost of the construction of the project.
Representative Guerra for the chair. Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Lee. On that point, on the firm transportation agreement, it was testified earlier by Marty Rutherford that we were within 2 weeks of an agreement with TransCanada if the buyout did not occur. Do you agree with that time frame?
Representative Munoz, through the chair. That's an aggressive schedule, in my opinion. The firm transportation services agreement is a very significant agreement. And it takes, even though we have agreed on a lot of the key terms in the present agreement, nevertheless, there's still a lot of areas that we need to complete before we have a full-blown agreement. And the matter of fact that it is a significant agreement for both parties, my experience has been that it will take longer than 2 weeks to get it done. Even assuming that we have a relatively smooth process. And also as well in the PA, it was more than just having the administration agree with us on the firm transportation services agreement, but it would also have to be sanctioned by the legislature before the administration can execute it. So the whole process, when you look at that, it will definitely take more than 2 weeks. Yeah.
Thank you. And another question, please. At what point, you said it's been several months that you knew the administration's position regarding a possible buyout. Did at that point that you began to realize that the direction was of the administration was to move with the buyout, did that compromise your ability to get work done on the project, or how did that affect your ability to interact with the partners or to work toward the goals of your partnership?
Representative Munoz, through the chair, we we start having awareness of the administration's intent to terminating the PA, the present agreement with TransCanada, back in May-June timeframe, I would say. And over time since then, as things continue to evolve, it did impact our ability to operate within the Alaska LNG projects, primarily on future agreements negotiations, because it's just a natural situation when parties realize that, or believing in that, you know, we soon no longer going to be parties to the project, it is difficult for them to allocate time to deal with some of the important issues that TransCanada has raised. And there's nothing wrong with any other parties having such a behavior, because, you know, there's a lot of issues on the table and people will have to find a way to maximize the time to deal with the real issues. And if they don't consider your issues are real because you're soon not going to be part of the project, it's difficult to convince them to allocate time to deal with our issues.
And then if I can have just a couple more, please. Another question I have is in regard to your understanding of where the interest would go if we decide to buy out your interest. Would it go directly to AGDC or would it come to DNR and then DNR would decide to designate it to AGDC?
I don't know for sure. Representative Manus, for the chair, sorry. I don't know for sure at this point in time. My impression has always been that it will, it most likely will go to AGDC. But the way the PA work is such that it is the, I believe it's the Department of Natural Resources will have to designate them to be the purchaser of our interests. So absolutely, I think the Commissioner of Natural Resources would have to make that decision first. But I always have the impression that it will go to AGDC.
And then just two more, please. Thank you. And then in terms of what would need to be done going forward if the buyout happens, what are the next steps? What is the exit strategy for TransCanada?
Representative Manus, through the chair, the process that we have been in discussion with the commissioners of natural resources is such that, you know, two parties is in the process of working out what we call a purchase and sales agreement. The purchase and sales agreement is a typical agreement which, which two parties agree to, for one party to acquire another party interest in an entity, and we expect that, you know, it would we would be able to finalize it within a short period of time. This is relatively a straightforward transactions, and with that, you know, as the purchase and sales agreement executed, we would at the same time receive we will receive a termination notice from the state, and then the closing would be shortly after that, but it will be before December the 4th, so that by December the 4th, the state will be the owner of the TransCanada entity that we used to invest in the Alaska LNG project, and is the party to the PFIT joint venture agreement. And at that point in time, being the owner of that entity, the state will be in the positions to vote for the 2016 work plan and budget.
Thank you. And then just one final question. If this does go through, what are some pearls of wisdom or advice to the state in terms of moving forward with the full 25% interest in all aspects of the project?
Buy low, sell high.
Representative Manus, through the chair, buy low, sell high is one option, I suppose. I think all major project development is going to take time, and there will be days that you feel you make a lot of progress, and there will be days that you're going to feel there will be some setbacks. I think you know, having focus on the overall goal is important, and keep working at it. And as we believe, this is a very a strong project with strong partners. I think you know, continuing effort to continue to push forward the progress will bear fruit at the end of the day. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Lee. Thank you.
Just only because it's on that point, Mr. Vincent, and how would the Alaska now is in the opportunity to be a player in the gas markets at a world-class value, and the amount of resources that are available in the state of Alaska. Several nights ago, Co-Chair Thompson and I were able to sit down with Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission chairs, and we talked about the availability and the quantities of gas and oil resources available in the state of Alaska, and they stated it's possibly up to 22 different basins that have similar geographic and geological formations, such as Prudhoe Bay, Point Thompson, but those are the only two developed so far. How would the world look at Alaska as a resource development if we were to not continue moving forward in a project like this and to drop out?
Mr. Co-Chair,
that's an opinion, but
yeah,
you do this globally.
I think everyone understand this project is important to Alaska for the fact that this project is important for the state to monetize the Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson gas for sure, but it's also a signal to the rest of the world that there's a conduit there, and there is a positive business environment for things to happen in Alaska. And as a result of that, I think what you will see likely is that there will be more people be interested in coming to Alaska to look for resources. And as we all believe that, you know, this gas pipeline, it will serve a function of basin opening. And I think, you know, that is important to keep in mind as well over time.
Thank you. We have Representative Edgman, Gaddis, Guttenberg, Wilson, and we got Representative Sadler in the queue here, but we're trying to make sure everybody has opportunities. So, Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairman. Mr. Lee, I really appreciate you coming before the committee today as well. I think you've been telling us fairly unequivocally that the decision essentially has been made for TransCanada to exit the project. Is that your baseline message this afternoon?
Representative Edgman, through the chair, yes. Given the circumstances, yes.
If I make it
ahead, Representative.
Just a couple of questions. While we have you here before us, related to the project as well as for informational purposes, is there a scenario where with what appears to be more and more a long-term environment of low oil prices, where this project, given the equity positions of the major investors outside of the state of Alaska, does not get built in the 2020s?
Representative Edgman, through the chair, you know, we have been in the oil and gas business long enough. We have seen commodity prices comes down, goes up. I think what you're seeing here is a typical cycle. When things are high, I don't think we should always believing that it will stay that high as well. Equally, when it's low, I don't think we should believe that it would always stay that low. So I think important is to keep focus on, you know, on the longer term, what you really believe the economics of oil and gas, and in terms of price equilibrium, and project like this, which takes many, many years to develop, one of the things you want to avoid is to focus on short-term forecasts.
If I may follow up with two more sort of unrelated questions. Given TransCanada's experience with mega projects throughout the world, can you give me your opinion on how the rest of the world, quote-unquote, in terms of oil and gas investment arena, the business world, how they would treat the exit of TransCanada from this project in the manner that it appears to be unfolding before us now versus years down the road when TransCanada would elect to terminate voluntarily on their own volition.
Representative Edmund, through the chair, I'm not an expert in a global oil and gas investment. I can't really express opinion on what other companies in the world would look at that. But I would describe the departure of TransCanada from this project is more on a mutual basis, even though it is in fact the administration who suggested TransCanada. But that doesn't mean that like TransCanada disagree with that. We've gone through our process and we understand the concern and we understand the position of the administrations, and we come to the conclusion that that is for the betterment of all involved party for us to depart. And so I would describe from that perspective that it is more of a mutual agreement for us to leave the project, and it makes sense for everyone. And we do not want to be an issue to the project as well, as I have expressed before, as being someone who we really believe that this project has a lot of potential. We want to see that this project actually will come to fruition. So we want to ensure that our exit is orderly and as smooth as possible.
And if I might, Mr. Chairman, my
Representative Edgman.
Last question would be to get your comments on the value of the state of Alaska having being a general partner versus a limited partner in the joint venture agreement, and the value of having that distinction. And perhaps you might address it from the perspective of the value it brought TransCanada have been there at the table before early June and late May, when the state, through the Department of Natural Resources, began indicating that they desired a termination of TransCanada's involvement in this. But the reason I ask this question is because it would seem to be, to me, from a business perspective, pretty valuable to have those voting, that have that voting opportunity. And I know there's some contingencies built into, I think it's the precedent agreement and so on and so forth, as to how TransCanada would have ordinarily communicated with the state of Alaska. But I just wanted to get your thoughts on the value of having that full opportunity to vote in the joint venture agreement team.
Representative Edman, through the chair, if you're a direct investor in the project, I would agree with that. Your voting rights in the project should be commensurate with your investment. Again, I think it is all come down to what's the philosophy behind the whole thing. If one believes that it has, TransCanada as being an independent pipeline company has value that it can contribute to the project, short term and long term, the arrangement that the last administration has done with us, from my opinion, it makes sense. And being the direct investor in the project, we certainly are entitled to have the voting right in the project. And the voting right is important from the fact that, because we are the party going to put billions of dollars in the project, and we should have the ability to influence the process to manage the risk of our investment. The philosophy of the current administration, I believe, is that, they want to have a direct say in the project, and as such, they acknowledge that comes along with that is the direct investment. And with that, it makes sense if you put money into the project directly, you should have a direct voting right, which in that part is no different than what TransCanada believe. If we are the party put the money in, we should have the voting right. If the state is going to be the party going to put the money in, the state should have the voting right.
Representative Edgman.
Yeah, I'll stay away from all the analogies that the good member from Fairbanks offered up earlier. I think those sort of stand on their own, but it's just, it strikes me how in the normal deliberative process here at the committee, we spend a lot of time taking sort of the deductive logic approach where we take the big picture and break down the smaller picture, whereas you really get the sense now that we're taking the opposite approach. We're sort of reconstructing what's already happened so that we better understand it. We're sort of operating in the context of the aftermath as opposed to really deliberating a decision that we're about to make. So I just offer that up as a commentary because it seems to me that that's the context that sort of frames our discussion.
Thank you, Representative Edgman. Representative Gaddis.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for being here, Mr. Lee. My colleague to the left of me asked a lot of the exit questions and some of the things that we asked the administration a couple days ago in regards to exit strategy, exit plans. Something that you said in your opening statement when you talked about, and I'm not sure what the exact word is, and here's what I found to be is, if I'm not asking the exact, even though it's an exit plan, but if I'm not asking the right term of the actual document, it's interesting that, and I'm certainly not saying with you, but administration we have struggled with. So for starters, the purchase and sales agreement certainly will spell out what the obligation of TransCanada, what the obligation of the state will be. But you said something about there was a plan that was shelved, and it was more, you had discussed maybe it was an exit strategy or exit plan, and I may have the term wrong, but what I'm asking is...
Amended plan?
Was that it? Okay, so I know that I have to ask the right... Why is it shelved? Why isn't it part and parcel to what we're doing? Here's where I'm going. The administration certainly has indicated that they've made the decision to buy out TransCanada. And they were pretty clear about that a couple days ago, and you certainly were clear here today. But with that, how we go about this process so that we as the state of Alaska protect ourselves and, more importantly, have the information and the employees that are working with us as we move along. So I guess I'm asking this, what is it, amended agreement that's been shelved, how does this play into the purchase and sales agreement and us moving forward?
Representative Gaddis, through the chair, the amended present agreement, I believe is the agreement that you are referring to, it was in draft form. It was an exit process for TransCanada smoothly transition out from the Alaska LNG project. We worked with the administrations for a few months on that amended agreement. It was based on a slightly different understanding of how the process would work. At the end of the process, we understand from the administration, and the administration has clarified with us that process didn't work out in the way that, you know, we were talking about for a few months, and so it put on shelf for that matters. And moving forward, you know, we are at a point where the administration has made requests to the legislature for approving the appropriations, and we are, of course, with the assuming that, you know, the bill would get passed, and we will. With that in mind, we are moving forward with a plan which formulate how the transaction itself is going to happen. So the amended present agreement is a framework for an exit. The transactions will still have to happen. The transactions, how you can effect that, would always be under what we call a purchase and sales agreement. So even if the amended present agreement was executed, we will still need a purchase and sales agreement to effect the transaction. So what we're doing here today is, you know, we basically shortcut the process because we kind of know what the exit plan now. We just move straight into the purchase and sales agreement to effect the transactions.
So, Mr. Chair, so what I'm hearing you say is that exit agreement, the amended that you put on the shelf, it's no longer necessary if we fast forward and you sign a purchase and sales agreement. That will take care of some of the things that were in that exit strategy.
Representative Gaddis, for the chair. Yes, that's correct.
Okay, thank
yes.
you.
Thank you, Representative Gaddis. Mr. Lee, will TransCanada allow their project secundees to stay with the project during the transition process? And
Mr. Co-Chair, as part of the discussion that we have with the administration, we have agreed to have our secundees to stay on until the end of May next year to make sure there's a smooth transition.
The end of May of 2016?
2016.
Okay. How many employees is that?
50, Mr. Co-Chair, the entire secundee teams from TransCare currently is 15 people.
All right. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lee, I'm going to lead you up for my line of thinking right up to the December 4th meeting. So sometime in May, you have been in the developed the mindset, or maybe before that, I don't know, I'll just use that, use May. You've been assuming that you were going to, somebody, the state was going to terminate the relationship, and that you clearly have been framing your work to get to that point. That's my impression. You don't have to say that. I think I've heard that enough times from different people. But what – and you said even if we don't, the FTSA would take more than 2 weeks to get done, which gets us into the middle of November or the end of November. And you haven't worked on a budget for the next year, assuming that TransCanada isn't somebody that pulls out. What happens in that December 4th meeting when the voting isn't clear? I don't know how big the issues are that are going to be on the table at that meeting. Maybe you know, maybe they haven't been developed yet. Maybe it'll just be a brief meeting, but it's clearly something that's on date. But if the relationship isn't terminated and the voting isn't as focused and understood as the administration tells us it is, what happens to that meeting? How confused does that meeting go, and how disruptive is that to that process?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair. It will be a very difficult meeting. My suggestion is that, you know, the better person to ask that question will be Steve Butt on Friday. But from my perspective, you know, I think it will put at risk the project. For sure that it would, for minimum, it would cause significant impact on the momentum of the project, because if there's no budget for next year, starting January the 1st, 2016, there will be no authorization for work to happen. And so in order for the project to continue on to move forward to get the pre-FEED deliverables ready, that will be a significant setback to the project. One can even extend it and say, if that is the case, you know, perhaps the project will even need to wind up, because there's no authorization to spend past midnight December 31st this year. So it is a critical decision and a critical decision point that, you know, all involved parties would have to decide how we're going to handle December the 4th vote. And that's the reason why we have been saying that it is important for the termination process and the transaction for the state to acquire TransCanada interest in the project to be complete before December the 4th, such that the state can be in a position to vote on the 2016 work plan and budget on December the 4th.
So, if I may, Mr. Chair,
just to clarify on that, if I could, I mean, so we're talking December 4th. If this transition funding doesn't take place or you don't get your payment, and you will be sitting at the table on December 4th, would you your people vote to approve or not approve the work project and budget?
Mr. Co-Chair, it will be very difficult for Transcare to vote affirmatively on that budget because, you know, any vote we have to undertake it in good faith. And knowing that we are still not going to be in the project, if we vote in that direction, it would not be a good faith vote, in my opinion. Now, I'm not a lawyer, but I would have hesitation to vote affirmatively.
Okay. Representative Guttenberg.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. You asked my question that we are, in many ways, and some of us are disappointed we didn't know this earlier, one way or another, that we weren't involved or didn't understand it, that if we make the wrong decision, we could go home not being able to defend ourselves. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Guttenberg. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks again for being here and for all the work that you've done. I'm sure you've done a lot more than many of us can even understand at this point. So, and this is just, I never sat on resources, so, you know, maybe you answered this and I just didn't quite get it. So in the contract that we currently have with you, and if we were to follow it all the way throughout, was TransCanada at all responsible for any of the gas going down that would have been the Alaska share, or was that always our responsibility to find someone to buy?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, it will be the state responsibility to find the buyer for the gas.
Follow-up, sir?
Representative Wilson.
So even in the contract that we had with your company, it still was our responsibility?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, yes.
Okay. And another question, Mr. Chair?
Representative Wilson.
So, you know, from my understanding, you know, when this, it sounds like in May or June that pretty much it was done. So it's kind of a dual question. At that time, why didn't you get out, noting that, you know, pretty much, you know, nothing else was going to happen? Or, you know, if you still thought maybe there was a little bit of hope, do you think it would have been more advantageous for the state at that point to have gotten out versus wait until now?
Representative Wilson, through the chair. First of all, you know, we started having discussion with the administration. The administration has expressed to us that the desire to have us to leave the project. But we have not yet concluded that, you know, how this is going to work. As I said, you know, we do not just simply want to walk away from the project because we know that there will be consequences of, you know, impacting the project by us just simply walking away. So we have always been working cooperatively with the administrations to map out a process such that our exit will be orderly and as smooth as possible. What you're seeing that TransCanada willingness to allow our secondees to remain with the project for a period of time is the result of some of those discussions that we have.
Perfect. And one more. And I'm going to tell you, I really appreciate that, the professionalism. I mean, you could have, at that point, said it's not working, walked away, and told the state of Alaska, good luck. And I want to tell you, I'm glad you didn't do that. And so my last question really is, so with all this uncertainty happening, you know, at that point, and so, you know, from May or June all the way to now, do you think at all that, you know, and this is just your opinion because you know much more about this than I do, do you think it slowed down the project at all?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, not in this particular instance. I think throughout that period of time, you know, we and even today, we're still an active participant in the project. True enough, you know, over time, you know, the degree of influence that we have in the project, you know, slowed down, per se. But it's really just the bilateral issue between TransCanada and the state. From the project perspective, the project continue on to carry out all the activities that it was set out in the pre-FEED work plan and budget. And parties are working hard to get the pre-FEED deliverables done, including TransCanada secondees to the project, working very hard to make sure that, you know, we meet the deadline, we meet the target date. So from that perspective, I don't believe that, you know, the interaction between TransCanada and the stay on TransCanada exit has any impact on the progress of the project at all.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, just a comment. I just hope those who are listening, and whether it's legislators or the public, how significant that this is. I mean, a company could have walked away, and we would have definitely slowed down the project trying to figure out how to fill all those in. And I sure hope we have a good way of showing how grateful we are that they didn't just walk away, but they also kept things going forward. And in reality, we're the ones who are going to have all the benefits because of that. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wilson.
I think just on that point, Representative Wilson, Mr. Lee, we've had discussions earlier about secedents that would be employees of TransCanada that would help within the transition through July should the state take over TransCanada's role in that. Can you explain how that happens?
Mr. Co-Chair, yes, sure, yes. We have agreed with the administration, you know, as a result of TransCanada exiting the project to ensure there will be as little impact to the momentum of the project and as a smooth transition process, TransCanada would have the secondees to the project continue with the project for a period of time until end of May 2016. And that would be a natural point, in our opinion, to have a smooth transition because by that time, if not all, most of the PFID deliverables would have been done. So it would be a natural transition point for some other individuals to take on TransCanada role in the projects from the secondees perspective.
Thank you. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Many issues have been raised. I got a number of questions. Let me just pick up a spare real quick before I go back to my other questions. You had said that there was a decision to shelf the amended PA agreement, and that I think you answered Representative Gaddis's question, that there really wasn't much difference between the purchase and sales agreement and the amended PA agreement. Is that a fair – was there any particular policy issue that they got hung up on, and who made that decision to shelve the amended PA?
Representative Stadler, through the chair, the amended PA, as I mentioned earlier, is an agreement to map out a process to put TransCanada exit the project. Again, it's not the same as the purchase and sales agreement, which even if we had executed the amended precedent agreement, we would still need to have a purchase and sales agreement to allow the transaction to take effect. The amended precedent agreement, the way it evolved was such that the administration at that point in time described to us that, you know, they would like to terminate TransCanada and then follow that with submitting an appropriation request to the legislature. And so, you know, that was the foundations of the draft amended precedent agreement. Towards the very end of that discussion, I think decision was made at the administration that they don't think that was the right process, and that was the result. You know, the result of that was that, you know, the draft agreement was put on a shelf.
I don't see, thank you, Chair. I don't see any difference between what you described as a process that was abandoned and the process that has been pursued. Again, I don't want to pick at this too much, but again, it sounds like there was not much of an issue, but you also said it was a three-month process to negotiate, then it was shelved. So, again, who was it that shelved it? What was the reason? I still don't quite understand the daylight between what was proposed and shelved and what actually happened.
So Representative Stadler, through the chair, if I can summarize it, the amended present agreement, the significant difference between where we are today in the current process versus what the process that we and the administration had in mind at that time was that, you know, in the amended present agreement case, the administration would issue TransCanada termination notice before there's a appropriation request submitted to the legislature.
So it's the sequence. Okay, great. Yeah. Thank you. Okay, so to my main questions then, you actually provide us a wonderful window of into a somewhat opaque world. I just became aware as a result of this morning's Senate Finance meeting of the existence of an AGDC subsidiary for the purposes of aggregation. And there was also reference made to a second subsidiary that would deal with, I think I heard him say, assuming TransCanada's assets. So could you give me your understanding of the of these subsidiaries and their purposes, their origins, and if there are any others likely to come down the pike that we don't know about yet?
Representative Stetler, through the chair, I have no knowledge of those subsidiaries. Those are internal matters of AGDC. There was no discussion with TransCanada, so I will not be able to comment on that.
Okay. Thank you, through the chair. Thank you, sir. We were told by DNR a day or two ago that they were willing to disclose the terms of the Preston Agreement from the first day the administration took office, and they intimated that it was TransCanada's desire not to make those terms public that prevented them from doing so. Can you elaborate on that? Is that indeed the case, or can you help me understand that dynamic a little bit better?
Representative Stetler, through the chair, the present agreement is typically an agreement that, you know, in a commercial world, we would want to keep it confidential, bearing in mind that, you know, the next step of the present agreement is the negotiation of the firm transportation services agreement. We certainly, as a commercial party, do not want to overly expose what we have in the present agreement before we complete the negotiation on the firm transportation services agreement. And that was the basis that, you know, we would like to keep it confidential. Of course, you know, thing has changed, and we understand that, you know, we're not highly unlikely there will be a firm transportation service agreement today. So to facilitate the process of what we are doing here, we agreed to provide a redacted version of the present agreement.
So in other words, the more vital, the more private confidential information, that being the terms of the FTSA, your company's terms of operation, were removed from that PA. It was not completed, and therefore the PA had less effect. So Moxnex, why not release it? Is that correct?
Representative Stetler, through the chair, yes.
Okay. There's also, to further that line, there's been a little bit of confusion on some folks' part as to who has filled what role and who served what function on the state's side in the relationship between TransCanada and the state. I do this not to rehash the past for its own sake, but in an attempt to make sure we don't repeat any similar mistakes going forward in the future to the goal we all desire. So help me understand, what is your working understanding of the lines of authority on the state's side as you've worked through the AKLNG project? Who's in charge over there? Who's your go-to guy?
Representative Sattler, currently, in terms of dealing with the termination, we are working directly with the commissioners of natural resources. The commissioner has the authority to terminate TransCanada, and we believe he is the right party for TransCanada to work with. When we were negotiating the amended present agreement, my counterparty was Mr. Boykin. I don't think I'm in a position to comment on the inner working of the state, because I think, you know, as a third party, even though we deal with the administration all the time, but I'm not sure that, you know, internally how they work, because I don't think that we have ever described that to us.
You and us both, but appreciate that.
On that point,
sure. Oh, yeah.
Who's been the lead negotiator with the state and TransCanada between the parties?
Mr. Co-Chair.
Who's your point of contact? Who's been the negotiator with TransCanada?
Mr. Co-Chair, the point of contact for TransCanada from a state perspective, it changed from issues to issues. As I said, you know, early on during the amended PA process, it was Mr. Boykin. And currently on termination is the Commission of Natural Resources. And we also work with the state gas team. The number of experts there, we work directly with them on a number of project issues. We work with the Deputy Commissioner of Revenue on some of the issues that pertain to the jurisdictions of the Department of Revenue, like on financing. There's a financing sub-team, and we work with the Deputy Commissioner there. So it depending on, you know, what's the topic that we're talking about, different individuals with the state team kind of looking after different things, and that and different individuals are our point of contact depending on what the nature of the issues in front of us.
Thank you, Representative.
I appreciate that. Go ahead. Continue. And I guess I'll continue. You've given some great answers and very informative answers to the question about the implications of TransCanada taking a vote in the state's behalf on December 4th or not. I guess help me understand, have there been votes taken to date? Has that process been utilized? Have there been votes taken where the state's interest and TransCanada's interest have been aligned and it's been easy to take those votes?
Representative Stetler, through the chair, yes, there were votes at the management committee before, and as far as I recall, I don't believe there's any exceptions that, you know, our vote has always been aligned with the interests of the state.
And the last and the final line on that question, thank you. And what is the we've been told there's a negotiation of governance agreements. Do you know what the status of the development of those governance agreements has been?
Representative Stetler, can you repeat your questions again?
Sure. I know you're kind of on the outs, but can you give us any perspective on what the current status is of the development of governance agreements?
Representative Stetler, through the chair, it's going along quite well as far as I understand. It's not yet finalized. The among the free producers in the state, I think there are a number of things that they are aligned already. Of course, you know, since the FEDA has not been finalized, that means there's still some outstanding issues. From TransCanada perspective now, we are on the way out, so it's probably not as relevant, but we do have significant issues with respect to the current model if we are parties to the project go forward.
You said related to the which model?
Related to the governance model that being currently in a draft form.
And just as a final flip, and who is currently in charge of negotiating? Who are the parties to that negotiation of those governance agreements?
Representative Stetler, through the chair, it will be all the free producers. They all have representatives there. TransCanada, AGDC, and state administration.
And who's taking the state's seat?
Representative Stetler, through the chair, if I understand it correctly, I believe it is Mr. Boykins as the chief negotiator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Stetler. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A moment, I'm going to take a page out of Representative Munoz's book. She was smart to ask for your advice on something, and I was, in my personal investing world, I always thought it was buy high, sell low. So hopefully I'll be able to take your advice. I think there's an issue that Representative Wilson raised. It's probably for another hearing at some point, but her concern that the state would have to sell the gas and take that risk, I think we resolved some of that in SB 138, where I think we have the option to have the producers sell our gas at the same terms they sell their gas. We can talk about that later. That's not for Mr. Lee.
And for the committee's review, we are preparing an updated version of 138, what was requested in 138 and where we're at each one of those points. So we'll have that for the committee as soon as we're prepared.
Thanks. Mr. Lee, one of the things that that many of us in TransCanada were in alignment going way back was it's in your interest to sell as much gas as possible, so you wanted as big a or as expandable a pipe as was reasonable, and for the state, we wanted as expandable a pipe as was reasonable to sell as much gas as we could. But there's the question that was raised before, and I just want to have you maybe help us as we look at this in the future. We know what reserves are known on the North Slope, right? It's almost circular, but we know what's known. And then on the other hand, we know that there's a belief that there's a lot more gas on the North Slope, but nobody will develop it until or explore for it until there's a market for it. So how do can you give us any kernel of advice in as we're deciding what size pipe to build? We want to sell as much gas as possible, obviously. As we're deciding what size pipe to build, how do we factor in not just the known reserves of gas, but the gas that nobody will explore for until there's a market for it? How do we factor in that not completely known reserve of gas on the North Slope? And
Representative Garrett, for the chair, I think that's a billion-dollar question. As you all know, the project team is looking at a 48-inch versus a 42-inch pipeline analysis right now. And based upon our experience as a pipeline company, technically, I think both pipeline can be built. It's a technical aspect of it. The question is how much it will cost additional in terms of a 40-inch pipe, and what are the additional risks involved. I think you need to go through the pre-feed and perhaps even go in a little bit into the feed process to get a better feelings on that. Question is, you know, how long can we keep on working on both configurations before we need to settle down on one configuration, because we need to settle down on one configuration to move forward the regulatory process as well. As a pipeline company, you know, we always are pro expansions because we like to have more investment over time. Expansions means incremental investment. It is not a straightforward answer about, you know, well, there could be more gas up there and should we oversize the pipe up front. I think it is there's a lot of factors you have to look into to make decisions on whether it is worthwhile to pre-invest. What is your expectation on a probabilistic standpoint that there will be additional gas up there, how much they are, at what point in time they will be available to the system? If it is not relatively soon after the project goes into operations, there might be a better way to do it by building an optimum system at the very beginning and then further expand it down the road. If it's relatively soon after the in-service, maybe the pre-investment makes sense. A lot of that is a function of time value of money. Time value of money is very powerful. It would eat into the economics of the project really fast. So knowing the gas but not knowing the timing of when it's going to be available, it's something that you want to have a good handle on before you make a good decision on whether it's worthwhile to pre-invest or not.
Thank you. For now, I'll just go with buy low, sell high.
I think I'm curious if I can follow up on that. Are we at the point in time where we can actually make an informed decision of whether to do a 48 or a 42-inch pipe? Do we have enough information? Is there enough information available to make that decision?
Mr. Co-Chair, as we stand today, no, I don't think so. And that's the part of the reason why the project team, at the request of the administration, is working on both a 48 and a 42 pre-feed analysis. It should be done, and the pre-feed deliverable for both should be available sometime in April next year. At which point, I think there will be more data on the table for people to make more informed decisions. But I think more importantly as well is, you know, beyond the technical aspect of it, one should also take a look at what is your expectation, and based upon whatever information that you might have today, your assessment of the potential of the basins go forward and what you think the future economics of those so-called probable gas. Because, you know, only the combination of the technical aspect of the project or of the analysis together with those, you can make only with those information in place, then you can make a decision on an expected basis what you think is a better case for the you know, for the project to move forward in one configuration versus the other configurations. And we are not privy to those information, so I really cannot tell. But in terms of information required, I would suggest that, you know, you need both sides of it.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Lee. I was curious about the concept of withdrawal agreements. I understand that administration is working with the other partners to secure agreements that would force the gas to the project, even if they weren't participants in the ownership structure. Could you just comment on the practicality of that, and is it a technique that's used in other jurisdictions? And does it help or does it hinder the progress on a project?
Representative Munoz, through the chair, you know, we are not an oil and gas company, so I don't have firsthand knowledge of how these kind of matters handle in other jurisdictions. I would suggest that, you know, this is probably a better question for some of the experts to answer than myself.
Thank you. Okay.
Thank you, sir. TransCanada's departure from this project will leave a rather big hole, frankly, in the view that I've had, a lot of people have had, and that holds the financing aspect. So are you aware of any assumptions or intentions that the administration might have regarding who or what will replace TransCanada's role as a financier for the gas treatment plant and the pipeline portions, the midstream? Have you any inkling of who they might have in the wings?
Representative Stafford, through the chair, no, I don't. I suppose, you know, I have sat through the presentation provided by the administrations, and it seems to me, you know, the potential sources of financing that they have identified are, in fact, reasonable source. So I trust, you know, the administration's experts on that have looked into the universe of possibilities.
And I appreciate you giving us the chance to kind of pump you for information and perspectives. It's kind of like an exit interview almost. But do the changes in the LNG market globally, as Representative Newman, Chair Newman has said, they're going towards shorter term contracts, a little bit more of a buyer's market than a seller's market. Are there changes in the LNG global market that you think would be instructive for us to keep in mind as we go forward with this project and whatever form it's going to be in?
Representative Stafford, through the chair, I think the fact that, you know, parties going to invest like $45 to $60 billion into this project, you certainly need to keep an eye on the evolutions in the marketplace. Just a few years ago, we never expect that, you know, shale gas would be such a big impact to the marketplace, and indeed it happened. So, I mean, with that in mind, I think, you know, we all have to pay attention to the rest of the world and the industry as to what is happening. Certainly the LNG market is changing as well, alongside with many other things. But I think perhaps the more important thing is the supply and demand balance. You know, at the end of the day, if there's a market there, there will be a place for the gas.
Thank you, sir. And I would just add my comments. I appreciate the extent to which TransCanada has been involved for such a long time, what a professional attitude and helpful demeanor you've brought to the whole process. And so I add my congratulations and thanks to you that you've heard from other members. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Just somewhat along those lines, as Representative Sadler, and while we've got an opportunity again to talk to somebody who deals in world-class markets, is Alaska's gas different than other gas around the world with the quantity of BTUs, and do we have a better quality of gas that's a more marketable gas globally?
Mr. Co-Chair, from a commodity standpoint, I think all gas around the world is more or less the same. It's a commodity market. I think the Alaska gas has an advantage because it's closer to the Asian market. I think, you know, that is an advantage the Alaska gas has. I think the Alaska gas has the advantage of you have very, very strong sponsors, the three major oil and gas company, very experienced company, have done these things many times before. Those are all very strong aspects of the Alaska gas project, for sure. But in terms of the molecules itself, I think, you know, it is a commodity. Yeah. You need to be price competitive.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you, Vincent, Mr. Lee. And the rest of your gas line team. I'll have to mention also we have Tom Roberts, Tom, and Patty Bowalski, Patty. And obviously Patty, I think, is probably available for questions if people have questions further on down the line, and she can get them to this. And I'd also like to note that our resource co-chairs have been here throughout the process here. And I think that they're also looking at doing some updates and making sure legislators have an opportunity to learn more with House Bill or Senate Bill 138, how that worked out. So I think they'll get that posted. Dave, is that right? Okay, Representative Tallarico, Representative Nagyak. With that, thank you, TransCanada, your assistance and your partnership while we've had it, and your cooperative. You're very cooperative to work with, and you've always been very informative of what you do, so thank you for what you do. You. With that, we have Thursday coming up. Analytica, initial analysis of the TransCanada proposal buyout with Janik Mayer and Nikos Tofas. So we will see you then. If folks have not read or updated the analytical's executive summary, I'd suggest that you do. Very, very informative. It's got great information in there, and it probably would help with some of the questioning tomorrow, so we can work on that. I know that they've been making themselves or trying to get to all the meetings that have been held here, so that I know when we're working on a presentation, they're trying to make sure we have the best updated presentation that gathers information from all the committees that have been held up to this point. So they're doing a good job on that front at the same time. So thank you all for your attention. We will adjourn for the day.